Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to the New Books Network podcast. My name is Katie Coldiron and I'm based at Florida International University in Miami, Florida. And today I am interviewing Pablo Alonso Gonzalez, who is the author of Cuban Cultural Heritage, A Rebel Past for a Revolutionary Nation by Pablo Alonso Gonzalez, released originally in 2018 from the University Press of Florida and released last year in paperback. Welcome to the show, Pablo.
Hi. How are you?
Good. And Pablo is also a senior researcher at the Spanish National Research Council. He's the author of several other books, including Cultural Parks and National Heritage Areas, Assembling Cultural Heritage, Development, and Spatial Planning. So, Pablo, what I like to do with these shows is just kind of ask our authors at the beginning the origin story of this work. How did this work come to be?
Well, that's a good one because I was doing a PhD in Spain. I did a PhD in history in Spain before. And while I was doing it, I got a grant to make an MPhil in Cambridge University in the UK. So I went there and that was the book you last read. That was my MPhil dissertation. And I got access to the PhD in Cambridge. And I thought this is a unique opportunity to have another PhD in Cambridge, you know, prestigious university and so on. And I thought on expanding my previous topic in Spain, but they said, no, we need like an international topic, something unique and so on. So I thought on Cuba because I had been in Cuba previously, just for 3 months, but basically because people from my region emigrated to Cuba from León to Havana. And I was interested, and also I was close to the Communist Party in Spain, so Cuba was always like the place to go and see how was communism in real life and so on, you know, a big delusion afterwards, but at the time that was it. So I had a few contacts there, and I thought I could do something interesting and unique, and there's not so much stuff done about Cuba. There's a lot of political writing about Cuba, but not so much when you go and look into the actual material that is covered by research. There's a lot of unexplored material and there's a lot of political and ideological debate about it. So that was really the idea. There was no plan, but I was interested in how Cuba separated from Spain because it never actually did, and how Cuba has preserved this, you know, spiritual relation with Spain throughout the century, even, and how the revolution brought about this communism in a Caribbean country and that crazy stuff that Cuba is today. And I thought that was going to be unique. And also I was interested in communism in heritage under communist regimes, which was also something that was not explored at the moment. And at a library in Cambridge, I found a book by a Romanian writer, Communism and Cultural Heritage. And I thought, wow, no one has read this book. No one has written anything about this guy, Eleazar Baller. So I used that book to interpret what was going on in Cuba. And I made a paper about communism and cultural heritage. So that was my idea. trying to explore these things, and then heritage was the, I don't know, the alibi to do it.
Thank you so much for that very fascinating origin story. So obviously you begin this book not with the Cuban Revolution of 1959, but rather with the Cuban Republican period. So following centuries of Spanish colonialism and then U.S. occupation immediately after. In your opinion, what qualities most characterize the creation of public monuments and museums during the Republican period?
It was a complex and contradictory period because there were pressures from the United States to be an exit, like Puerto Rico was and will be in the end. There was also a crazy, unique movement, which is that Spain lost the war, but half a million Spaniards migrated to Cuba after independence because Cuba was so economically successful. So even though bonds were being broken with Spain, a lot of Spaniards were coming there. So identity debates and the national idea were quite on the spot. And it was quite interesting how cultural elites in Cuba were trying to build a national identity against American, United States power, but also against the Spanish colony and building it from the scratch. So basically, it was quite interesting how it was basically a process that took place in Havana. Basically, social civic associations will create like an association for the promotion of the identity of Cuba for this fighter, José Martí. And they will raise funds, make a campaign, and you know, write posts in the newspapers and so on to collect money. And they will make a public bid for building a monument. Basically, Italian sculptors won these contests because Spaniards were banned from the contests. And basically, Cuba was filled of these monuments, like realistic monuments to fighters, like independence fighters, you know, for the Cuban freedom, as they say. But at the same time, the American-backed state, you know, at the beginning of the Republic was backing up and supporting the building of monuments to American lives and role in the war and so on. So there were a lot of monuments built from Santiago de Cuba to Havana commemorating the lives of American soldiers in the Cuban-Spanish-American War, which is also a topic of debate. And basically, I explored this topic in the book through the main monument, which, you know, as you know, the conflict was deflagrated by the explosion of the main ship in the harbor of Havana, and the United States said that it was Spain who had exploded the ship, and that that commemoration was really, really controversial, and many people were against supporting it and so on. But also the most important debate and the first that I explore in the book is about the monument to José Martí. José Martí today is well known as the most famous figure, historical figure of Cuban independence. But at the moment, it was not so clear. I mean, Cubans had no history, no newspapers telling the stories of the war and so on. So basically, they opened a bid in the Figaro, a local newspaper, about who should preside the central square of Havana. And the three options were Columbus, yeah. José Martí, and also the Statue of Liberty, of Freedom, from New York, like a copy of the New York statue in Havana. And actually, José Martí won, closely followed by Cristóbal Colón. But what was actually built was a Statue of Freedom. But people kept going there to the square and destroying the statue and so on. So it was a period of conflict. And actually, in the end, an statue to José Martí was built. And American Marines went there, you know, and speed over the statue and so on. So it was heritage was a site of contempt. And to, a place of negotiation of identity. And similarly, museums followed a different route because they were a part of what a modern state should be for the elites in Cuba, especially in Havana. So mainly the women of the, you know, the big entrepreneurs and the big statesmen of Cuba, they created an association for making a national museum and different specific museums about topics and so on. Or rich men like Bacardi in Santiago de Cuba created private museums, trying to imitate the European model of the, you know, the modern Cartesian museum with Egyptian mummies, a lion, Roman history, pottery, I mean, all kinds of stuff, because that was a sign of modernity. So I think this will be a good summary, although quite a complex debate, and it's more developed in the book.
No, great summary for sure. And a great introduction to that chapter of your book. So obviously the bulk of this book is the revolution and after. And as you show, the triumph of the Cuban Revolution in 1959, which is a huge, you know, moment socially, politically, changes everything, but also the cultural heritage field. And you specifically talk about what you call the repurposing of public monuments from the Republican era. Could you tell us a little bit more about this?
Yeah, so basically, there was a huge debate at the beginning of the revolution about the role of heritage. And this happened in China, in Russia, in every revolutionary country, there was the same debate. Basically, what the socialist ideas predicated was that heritage was not necessary in a communist society. And this was like the more radical stance. Others advocated like an abstract and utopian use of heritage. And obviously, communist states are also states, and they realized that heritage was quite useful to convey ideas and so on. So part of this use of heritage as a form of imposing a new legitimacy and ideology in the public sphere was re-symbolizing the monuments and the museums and everything. And this meant not only changing the discourse, but also using material culture in different ways. For instance, the Square of the Revolution, which was a civic square, you know, this famous place where Fidel Castro was giving his 6-hour-long speeches and so on. It was like only a fascist architecture monument promoted by the Batista regime. And it was turned into an interactive place for meetings, rallies, and communist propaganda. And so they installed a lot of panels with Marx, Lenin, José Martí, Fidel. They put on speakers and a big television. So I had access to all these documents of how the process took place and all the debates inside the movement of what should be a heritage movement in this context. And of course, it's quite interesting because Cuba is not a communist state as such. And it, especially until the 80s, it was quite unique. It was more like a rebel state, as I like to call it. And they had their unique features, like the personality of Fidel, which never happened in the Soviet Union. You know, there were important characters in the Soviet Union, but it was not so much personalistic, while Cuba is completely personalistic in the figure of Fidel. And so this place became like completely re-symbolized. Even the Museum of the Revolution originally was there. Maybe we can talk about that later. So it was completely changed in terms of space. And it will be again after the 90s re-symbolized. So all the militarist and Soviet staff propaganda will shift towards the figure of José Martí. And how Cuba is like a humanistic state and ideologically neutral and so on. So this is one of the key examples of re-symbolizing monuments. But this took place throughout Cuba in monuments, in museums, everywhere. It was like a huge movement and it was planned, basically. Before the end of the war, I could locate some letters between the leaders Che Guevara and Fidel Castro sending to each other and saying, hey, we need to build a museum to tell the story of our feat. They didn't know what it was going to be, but they knew that they had to tell the story in a museum. And it's quite interesting that they had this idea of a museum, like a place to tell this story.
Thank you so much for that. And yes, the Museo de la Revolución discussion was one of my favorite parts of the book, and I did not know that it was originally there, nor anything about the origins of the, you know, Revolutionary Square that everyone knows as, you know, where Fidel gives his very drawn out speeches. So thank you so much for that. So with the 1970s, of course, you talk about what you refer to as the institutionalization of the Cuban heritage field. Most people consider this really the height of Soviet influence in Cuba. So I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about what you mean by institutionalization, particularly in the context of Cuba's strengthening relationship with the USSR and its satellites.
Yeah, so what I mean is the increasing influence of the Soviet Union in all regards. Basically, Cuba started to depend economically and politically almost completely on the Soviet Union. And the Soviet Union also started to have problems with China. So even within the communist world, there was this division between Maoists and Soviets and so on. So the Soviet Union was more strict in terms of, if I give you the money, I want your loyalty, you know? And this loyalty has a component of culture and aesthetics. So this meant that many people in Cuba started to be trained in the Soviet Union. And also many technicians from the Soviet Union came to Cuba to, I don't know what will be the right word, to oversee how things were being performed in terms of art, in terms of monument building, museum building, and so on. And many manuals were translated from the German republics, from Bulgaria, Romania, and so on, and applied to Cuba. I could see and read a lot of books translated directly into Spanish, from Russian, and so on. And those were applied. And also, there was a huge debate, especially in the 60s, between those more oriented towards UNESCO and the European left, if you want to call it, like the French European left and so on. And those were more humanistic, and there were more party-aligned people, you know, and even the party were recruiting artists of all kinds. But this debate was not closed, and that's something unique to Cuba. They did not impose a line. It was more or less going in some direction, but it was never imposed strictly. So there was, for instance, a commission created, CODEMA, the Commission for the Development of Monumental Art, but the same happened with museums. And no one has talked much in the literature about CODEMA. I had to find the archive myself and rebuild it because it was buried under a falling wall because, you know, the buildings in Cuba are completely collapsed after the special period and so on. And in this archive, you could see all the contests and the letters sent between the leaders and the artists. So there was like a huge, huge debate of how aesthetics should be, and monumental aesthetics in particular, no? So I think it's quite complex as a topic, and it's difficult to summarize because there were winners and losers in its monument. So it's not easy to say that someone won the battle. It was like a constant debate, and it took the best, I think this is important to bring to bear here, the most important debate was between socialist realism and abstract art. So basically, Cuban artists thought that abstract art was a form of freedom against the party, and the party thought that imposing socialist realism was a way of making happy their Soviet technicians, you know, overseeing how things were happening in Cuba. So in the end, many, many monuments in Cuba are the result of a negotiation between those two sides. And there are many examples in the book. Basically, the squares of the revolution in every provincial city they are living examples of this mixing of both. We can maybe talk about that later, but I think this is what the institutionalization meant, like an attempt to control or at least oversee what was happening in the heritage field in Cuba, but not only in the heritage field, in all fields, but heritage was also affected.
Thank you so much for that. As you know, allude to, there are debates happening at this time. I think that's kind of a misconception sometimes about, you know, you think of, you know, Cuba, totalitarian, and everything that's happening is, you know, coming directly from supreme leader. Yes, in some cases, but also no. So I really wanted to ask you about these two factions that you highlight in your book and who had a really formative role in cultural heritage, specifically the ex-guerrillas, the people that fought along, primarily men that fought alongside Fidel in the Sierra Maestra. And then you have museum professionals and academics, many of whom were trained in the Soviet bloc countries. What did the relationship between these two factions look like, and how did that impact cultural heritage projects in Cuba?
Well, basically, the ex-guerrillas, like the brother of Fidel, Raúl, and many others, the commanders, you know, all the commanders, became like a power within the power. So in Cuba, there was always a debate between the circle surrounding Fidel and the Communist Party. So those were two power structures that shared power, resources, and debates. It was never set as in the case of culture. So in a way, Raúl, for instance, the brother of Fidel, he was most closely aligned with the communist idea. He was from the Communist Party since the early beginning. And he was the leader of MINFAR, the Ministry of Defense. And he had like a really radical stance. So he thought that the heritage field was being quite taken over by the UNESCO advocates and so on. So even the Ministry of Defense created its own history section, and they started to build their own museums without bids. So for instance, the museums created by the Ministry of Culture and the monuments, they followed like a public bid process, and artists and architects, they had to make like a consortium and bid to the project. But the Ministry of Defense, they just put in charge of a museum or a monument to one person. And this person was often De Larra, who was a sculptor, an architect that, you know, built a lot of the socialist, realist buildings, figures of famous characters and so on. And there was like a really, really entrenched debate here. And as I say, it's important to think when you visit Cuba, well, who did this museum? Who did this monument? Because if you know who did it, you will understand the aesthetics. So you cannot discuss aesthetics without the genealogy of how the monument or the museum was built. And that's what I tried to do in the book, like going and see how were things built and who was in charge of doing it.
Thank you so much for that. So obviously, I mean, the next climactic point really in the book and in Cuban history is the fall of the USSR and the beginning of what's called the special period in Cuba, major socioeconomic crisis during the 1990s. How did this crisis materially impact cultural heritage projects as well as the ideological underpinnings of these projects that had existed up until this point?
Well, so for the people who knew the special period in Cuba, there was no money, no food, no building materials. People were becoming blind. And I mean, it was a terrible period. Many people still suffered the consequences. And the heritage field was no exception. There was a stop, a complete stop in the building of new monuments. All the monuments that were planned by CODEMA were stopped. And all the funds were centralized in the state to make 1, 3, 4 big monuments that had to be done in terms of ideology, ideological shift, and so on. And the main idea was to forget the Soviet past. There was no more training in the Soviet Union. There was no Soviet Union. There was no money, no projects, and no tourism. So they needed in Cuba like hard currency, and they started to open up processes of touristification. And of course, the Oficina del Historiador de la Ciudad de La Habana, the Office for the Historian of Habana City, was in charge of this. But also the state shifted from a revolutionary Soviet nationalist, Soviet mixed narrative towards more an anti-imperialist narrative, emphasizing the figure of José Martí. So the idea after the 90s is that monuments and museums have to emphasize the connection between José Martí and Fidel Castro, like as if saying that they are both the same figure. And Fidel just realized the ideas of José Martí. And you can see this in the hotspots of revolutionary power, like the Museum of the Revolution, the Square of the Revolution. A new museum was inaugurated, as I said, in the Square of the Revolution about José Martí. And all the busts to Lenin, they were replaced by busts to José Martí. So there was a huge factory in Havana building busts to José Martí and sending them all over Cuba, and replacing Lenin for José Martí. And also the museums had to re-symbolize all the Soviet past. It was fun because I could find some places in really remote areas of Cuba where there was no money and no interest in reconditioning the museums. So I could have pictures, and they appear in the book, about how museums were during the Soviet era, even in 2015, 25 years later. They were untouched completely. So this tells you a lot about this period. And also there was a lot of money put into the anti-imperialist war against the United States. So there was a lot of money put into the Elian case. This child that went to Florida in the boat with his mother, and that was like a huge case and so on. So they built like a huge anti-imperialist Tribune, and also they started to make more connections with Latin American leftist leaders, because there was this wave in Latin America with leaders leaning towards the left, Kirchner, Correa in Ecuador, Kirchner in Argentina, and so on, Lula in Brazil. So there was like an attempt to connect materially with Latin America, and so it's a complex time and a time of change, but basically the idea underpinning all the cultural heritage discourse was connecting the notion of Fidel is José Martí, but communist or more revolutionary.
Super interesting, and thank you so much for that explanation. So you had mentioned, and I think it's important to highlight this for the listeners, the Oficina del Historiador de la Ciudad de La Habana, the Office of the Historian of the City of Havana. As you mentioned and explained in the book, this is an office that existed since Spanish colonial times that gradually fades into obscurity, but then is revived, particularly with a turn towards tourism as the official economic model. Could you tell us a little bit about how the Office of the Historian grew into what it is and how it has traditionally approached its work under the leadership of Eusebio Leal?
Yeah, so the Oficina del Historiador was something created during the Republican times by Eusebio Roig de Leuchtenring. And he was a special character. He was a writer, a journalist, a historian. He appeared in all the newspapers, and he was really well regarded by all powers. And he connected the preservation of history in texts and archive research with the preservation of material culture from the past. So this idea, the office disappears when the revolution comes. He dies really, I mean, not Eusebio, Roig de Leuchtenring, he dies in oblivion because he was not a convinced revolutionary, and so it was downplayed by the revolution. But then after the 80s, Eusebio Leal takes over the Oficina del Historiador. Well, not takes over, reinvents the Oficina del Historiador and starts to work with his hands and people, friends of his. He starts rebuilding and recovering archaeological materials, rebuilding homes and so on. And so by the 90s, with the fall of the Soviet bloc, the Oficina is like something that works. It's not big, it's something small, but it's something that works. And Fidel Castro puts Eusebio in charge of rebuilding Old Havana. So Old Havana was seen as a symbol of colonialism. It was declared World Heritage in the 80s by the UNESCO-leaning academics in Cuba, but the leadership was not that much aligned with this idea. They still thought of Old Havana as something to be destroyed. And even during the 60s, it was a proposal to destroy Old Havana. And the Republican Times also saw Old Havana like an old place, you know, there was nothing to do there, and so on. So for the first time, someone says, hey, we can bring tourism and money through Old Havana and rehabilitating all that stuff. So basically, Old Havana was crumbling. Of the 3,400 buildings, I don't know, maybe, I don't know correctly, I have the numbers in the book, but around 2,000 buildings were either collapsed or in risk of complete collapse. And by the 90s, every 3 days, a building collapsed in Old Havana. So the idea behind the office is to bring money and use that money to rehabilitate the city. I think it's quite interesting as a management model, actually. And it was the first time that the Communist Party allowed some entity to be like a company operating privately. There is like a boundary between Old Havana and Havana now. The Office of the Historian has its own, it's like a private company. They have their buildings, their hotels, their museums. They have a tourism company. They have a radio, an editorial, a newspaper. So it's like they have people hired, like clowns and everything. But what is interesting is that the money that comes through tourism, through the hotels and everything, is redirected to restoring Old Havana. So it's not a for-profit, but it's a non-profit entity. And that is a quite interesting model, and it worked quite well. And Cuba, by the 2015, 2 million people were visiting Old Havana. So that's a lot. By that time, 3 million people were visiting Cuba as a whole. So for every three tourists, two were going to Old Havana. And it became like a beautiful city with a lot of problems and so on. But it became like a hotspot for diplomacy. If the King of Spain was visiting Cuba, it will be received not by Fidel, but by Eusebio Leal. And that was quite a change. And also, they rebuilt Havana not based on how Havana was during colonial times, but it was like quite a Caribbean theme park, you know, like quite of this kind of heritageization, inventing colors and so on. But for the Cubans, it was a site of color, of happiness, that contrasted clearly with the gray architecture of Soviet era buildings made in Yugoslavia and sent to Cuba and just assembled in Cuba. So that created a sense of identity. And I think that all stuff that has been done in Old Havana has been quite important in terms of changing the idea of Cubans about themselves and about their relationships with the world in many ways.
Thank you so much for that and that really interesting explanation of Eusebio Leal, which anybody interested in Cuba needs to know who this person was. So a key tension in this book, obviously, and is something you've that is exemplified by some key anecdotes in your book. For example, the reinstalling of the statue of José Miguel Gómez on Avenida de los Presidentes, which was taken down at the beginning of the revolution. is this conflict between kind of outward versus inward facing cultural heritage projects, or, you know, better said, projects designed for an international audience, a touristic audience, versus an internal Cuban audience, which the latter was obviously the focus of the, you know, from the 1970s up into the special period. How has this historically, this tension played out on the ground in Cuba, and what does it look like in this modern era of international tourism?
Yeah, this one is a difficult one, because the audience of heritage changes depending on the times and the conception of heritage. So it's quite a dynamic relation. But basically, we could say that during the Republican times, the audience was completely internal, but also trying to send a message to the United States saying, hey, we have a national identity and so on. So it was a political audience, let's say. In the attempt to create a national identity, of course, against the United States and the colonial power, Spain. Then during the revolution, again, there was no tourism, only a little bit of travels from the Soviet Union and so on. And therefore, again, heritage was a political tool. And only afterwards, after the 90s, we can not so clearly differentiate between monuments for the tourists and monuments for the locals, but in a way, they are. But if you go to the Museum of the Revolution, it's intended for the local public, but the tourists go to see like a relic of the Soviet era museography. It's like something fun, because they, if you talk and interview the guys at the Museum of the Revolution, and many others, I interviewed like 100 and so much people, and they are thinking of the museum as a tool for education. They don't have the money incentive, because in Cuba it's like a, you know, capitalist thing to have like a for-profit mentality. Only the Office of the Historian has a for-profit mentality. So it's a complex mixture. But if we want to use as an example, you mentioned José Miguel Gómez. José Miguel Gómez was a president during the Republic. And he was known to have repressed the black community a lot. So the result of hatred among the African Cuban community in Cuba against the memory of this president. So of course, when the revolution came, they torn down the statue in the Avenue of the Presidents of Cuba. So José Miguel Gómez disappeared from the history of Cuba until the Office of the Historian reclaims a new form of identity and history based on what they say is real history, because during the Soviet Union it was like a fake or fictitious, let's call it, a form of understanding history in terms of big periods and so on. So the Office of the Historian didn't know that it was going to be such a problem with the African community. And they restored the statue and, well, the monument, because it is a huge monument to José Miguel Gómez, for the sake of beauty and for the sake of reconnecting with the real past. And they did the same with the Capitolium, which was a clear symbol of allegiance to the United States during the Republic in Cuba. And the Communist Party was not so for the rehabilitation of the Capitolium. The Capitolium had been the natural museum during the revolution, because it was said that it was a symbol of power of America and proto-colonialism and so on. And so rehabilitation these symbols of past problematic ideas was a new form of relating with the world and with history by the Office of the Historian. What happened in the end with Eusebio Leal? Well, all this stuff that he did was not so well seen by the Ministry of Defense and Raúl, especially, who was the Minister of Defense. So when Fidel dies and Raúl takes power, he really downplays the office of the historian, and the Ministry of Defense takes over the Office of the Historian, and Eusebio Leal finally ends his life like in a secondary role, like really a historian, not an entrepreneur or a person with a lot of power, just as a historian writing books and so on. And the office is totally downplayed today. I mean, it has still a lot of money and moves, tourism, but it's like a heritage from the Eusebio Leal period.
Thank you so much for that. Kind of getting, obviously this research ended during the Obama era, and a lot has changed in Cuba since you began this research. So this is kind of a little bit more about your point of view, as someone who's done this very long and detailed work. In your opinion, what direction is cultural heritage in Cuba headed at this current moment?
Well, this is a moment of confusion because even after Raul, it's no one really knows how to define, even in academic circles, what's going on in Cuba, because there is no clear ideology. The connections with China are there, but are not so strong. They have not followed the Chinese model of industrialization and so on, and neither the Vietnamese model of, you know, transitioning slowly towards capitalism and so on. So it's quite difficult to understand. They are trying to connect more today. I mean, they have more freedom, that's clear. And they're trying to connect more with UNESCO and new museology, these kinds of discourses. And even museums and monuments today are not being created. Rather, they are being closed. There was a project to close down municipal museums. You know, one part of the book, I explained the process of creation of 400 museums in Cuba, all replicating in the same model. So now they are trying to close down at least half of these museums. So they are realizing that they cannot maintain such a huge network of museums and monuments and so on. So it's a moment of stalemate. I tell a fun story at the end of the book, which for me encompasses a little bit what's going on. You know, in Cuba there was no internet. Well, there is internet, but with a router and a modem are really slow, 56K. So you had to wait for 5 minutes to open, you know, Hotmail or Gmail or something, and to pay like €5 per hour, $6 or something. So there was, and for Cubans, there was no internet at all. So after the 2010s, more or less, in different moments, they start to open up Wi-Fi hotspots in main squares and so on. So this guy in Camagüey, a provincial city in Cuba, he was trying to get more Wi-Fi connection, and he climbed into the Agramonte monument. Agramonte is like one of the fighters for freedom in the independence war of Cuba. And basically the monument fell off. The guy, Agramonte, his horse and so on, like a huge bronze statue. And the guy's taken to the police station. The next day they rehabilitate the monument. They make the ceremony, and no one goes to the ceremony. Like the square was full of people looking for their Wi-Fi connection, their smartphone, both in Spain or in the States, and trying to get their connection. You know, they didn't care at all about all these ideas and heritage regimes that the state is trying to impose, you know. And there is also this case of trying to, I tell that at the end of the book, you know, the attempt to create a new museum with the European Union. The European Union was trying to fund a huge project together with the Office of the Historian of Havana, called the Palacio del Segundo Cabo. And this museum, it should tell the story of good relationships between Europe and Cuba. But the notion about the idea of Europe in Cuba is like a colonial power, you know, that bad guys, you know, the states, they are really bad, but Europe is also really bad. So it was really difficult for them to create a narrative of the museum. And I was part of it throughout 2 years. And I was trying to grasp how they were unable to develop new narratives, because even though The ideas and the techniques were there because there is a lot of money in the office of the historian, and they were hiring Spanish companies, Italian companies with all the techniques and so on. They did not know how to develop a narrative that was not against, but different from the state narrative of hatred against the West in general. So this tells a lot about the office of the historian and its limits, you know. It can rehabilitate old Havana, it can create beauty and so on, but without content. It's like aesthetics without content. So in a way, it replicates a little bit what is happening with heritage globally, you know, like a restoration of heritage for the sake of it and money and gentrification without any new narrative.
Thanks
That's
so
my
much. Yeah, thank you so much for that. And I love the anecdote about the guy climbing the statue in Camagüey looking for Wi-Fi. I feel like I've, you know, obviously you go to any Wi-Fi hotspot in Cuba, you're going to have, you know, tens of people at any given moment. So it's a really, it's an anecdote that says a lot. So I like to always conclude these interviews by asking the authors a little bit about their current projects and give them space to share a little bit about that. So if what are you currently working on? Do you have any projects that you'd like to share?
Well, after my PhD in Cuba, I published this book and also another book about my other PhD in Spain, which was called The Heritage Machine, which is more like a heritage ethnography in my region, in León, in Spain. And after that, I moved a bit more into anthropology and more applied projects in terms of food heritage, gastronomical heritage. And I got a position in the Canary Islands, which are really the sister islands to Cuba, because many Canarians went to Cuba and back and so on. And so I'm really surrounded by Cubans in my life. And so I'm not disconnected by the research from Cuba. It's like quite far away from me now. Currently, we are working especially in food heritage regarding Canary stuff, because all the Canarian gastronomic heritage has been disregarded completely, a little bit like Hawaii in the United States. And we have actually a guy from Hawaii that is applying with us for a postdoc position. And he says that it's quite similar. We have also volcanoes and so on. So that's the thing. That's what I'm doing. I'm not writing books at the moment. I don't have time, but I have a huge group working with me. We are like 12, 13 people. So I invite you, if you are interested in working with us. We are also working on heritage as well, but more local and less, I would say less international in scope.
Wow, yeah, that sounds like really fascinating work. So thank you so much for sharing it, and thank you for talking about this really great book with us. This has been Pablo Alonso Gonzalez talking about his book Cuban Cultural Heritage: A Rebel Past for a Revolutionary Nation. It is available via the University Press of Florida. And thank you so much again, Pablo.
Thank you. Thank you very much for this time to remember my times in Cuba. It's already a decade since I started visiting Cuba. Well, no, more than a decade, 2007.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. It was a pleasure for sure.
Thank you very much.